Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
We're into the last half of the Ontario election campaign, and it looks like a tight race with the PCs polling just a few points ahead of the Liberals. The Tories have taken some heat for their million jobs plan. To defend it, we're joined by PC leader Tim Hudak.
The blackout period for political advertising in the Ontario campaign has ended, which means your TV and radio are being flooded with ads. To break them down, we're joined by Jonathan Rose, an expert in political advertising and an associate professor at Queen's University.
Amidst violent clashes and ongoing tensions with Russia, Ukrainians head to the polls this weekend to choose their new president. Canada has sent 500 observers to monitor the vote, but security issues may limit the effort. We speak with Senator Raynell Andrechuk, who is in Kiev leading the mission.
We also discuss some organizational woes for the Quebec wing of the Liberal Party, and the McLean's panel weighs in on Justin Trudeau's battle with the Catholic Church over the issue of abortion.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to the Hill. In just 3 weeks, the people of Ontario will be heading to the polls to choose their next government. And midway through the election campaign, it's looking like a tight race. The most recent numbers from Ipsos Reid show the PCs in the lead with 35% support, while the Liberals follow at 31 and the NDP has 28.
For Tim Hudak's Conservatives, that's a slip of about 4 points from a week ago, while Andrea Horvath's New Democrats have received a boost and Kathleen Wynne's Liberals haven't budged. Despite this tightening race, John Wright, the senior vice president of Ipsos Reid, says the PCs still hold the advantage.
The reality is that for those voters that are going to turn out and vote, the Hudak Tories are well ahead in sitting in majority range.
It's not clear yet if new party ads released this week will make an impact on the polls.
We'll discuss that angle in a moment, but first, we're going to take a look at the man who wants to become the new Premier of Ontario. At a campaign stop in Ottawa, PC leader Tim Hudak sat down with McLean's political editor Paul Wells to talk about his plan to create a million jobs in Ontario over 8 years.
The first objection I often hear is there's only 500,000 Ontarians out of work today. So I assume this is cumulative it wouldn't be hiring every unemployed person in Ontario twice.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And look, we can give you the full list of each of the tools, what we expect that will do to spur our economy and what the jobs that come as a result from economic modeling. Mm-hmm. We can also show you how that builds over 8 years. So you're right, that is a cumulative total. It's also net. And I'm sure we'll talk about how we're going to reduce the size and cost of government. So that's a net million jobs in our province. So you ask me, well, there's only 565,000 people unemployed in the province. And that stats can data for those that they count as being unemployed. You layer on top of that the hundreds of thousands of people who are on welfare, who are able to work by definition of welfare, but aren't working. You put on top of that as well those that are struggling to get by in a part-time minimum wage job. My goal is to give them career jobs, good jobs, not jobs that they're stuck with. Okay. And on top of that too, Paul, there's a significant section of people who have just given up, that aren't caught in the stats can data, that aren't looking for work. And this is over 8 years, so you have population growth. Here's the other side of the argument. If we don't do this, if we don't create at least a million jobs over 10 years, we get to European-style stagnation. That's sort of the growth rate of the working population in the province. If we don't provide those jobs, we're actually going to be in the jobs debt spiral.
So a million jobs over 8 years. What's the record been over the past 8 years? Like, what's the ground state from which you want to improve things?
Yeah, I think it's around, we can get the exact number, but it's around 500,000 would be the previous record, which is not good enough. I mean, this is actually 7 straight years we've had higher unemployment than the national average. We've lost 300,000 manufacturing jobs. We did hit over, I think it was about 1.1 million from 1995 until 2003 under the previous PC government. So it's ambitious, no doubt, yeah. But it's doable. It's achievable, and the alternative is that we lose even more talent who will head out west, or they'll head to the States, and more job creators that will simply pass Ontario by.
You also say that you will have cabinet minister pay tied to performance.
Yeah.
Look, it sounds like a great idea, but are you going to be the Premier of Ontario who gets up after on the first anniversary of your election and says, my education minister is failing to meet her goals, I'm going to dock her pay? It's hard to imagine.
They did it in British Columbia, so why can't we do it in Ontario? In British Columbia, they failed to balance the budget or failed to hit their goals, so they all took a pay cut. So what I've said all the time, my cabinet's pay to those outcomes as well. I think it's only fair and reasonable to say to all of us that have that important job in cabinet, including Premier, that if you don't come through on doing what you told taxpayers you're going to do, you should have your pay docked as a result. Just put politicians' money, it's taxpayers' money, where the mouths are. We've done it in British Columbia. We had that law in Ontario until Dalton McGuinty watered it down. And make sure that you're focused on what's important, job creation, balancing the books.
Going back to 1995, I mean, it's striking. The last time Ontario changed governing parties to elect a Conservative was 19 years ago. And I've been thinking about what's changed, what's the same since then. Part of the context was that there was a Liberal government in Ottawa. And so Ontarians could decide they wanted a different path. Is it more difficult for you because there's a Conservative government here?
I don't think people make that decision. You might be right. I've been doing this for 18 years. I've knocked on a lot of doors. Right? Mm-hmm. My own campaigns and by-elections as leader, as a volunteer for the PC party before that. I've yet to meet a voter who says, I'm tired of the corruption. I'm tired of the job losses. My daughter can't get a job. But I'm going to vote for the Liberals again because we've got a Conservative federal government. I just don't think people believe that.
Okay. Part of the problem in 2011 for you was the your reaction to a McGuinty plan to offer a tax incentive for businesses that hire new Canadians. Do you think that sent a signal that the Ontario PC Party was not the right choice for immigrant voters? And are you trying to send a very different signal now?
I should have been talking about jobs. I should have been talking about what I believe in. One of the questions you asked me a little while ago, Paul, was, you know, what's different? And I gave you a very direct answer there. Let me give you some more detail. You and I have been talking since the last election, and I spent a lot of time in those 2.5 years thinking about what's actually going to work, what doesn't work, what do I believe in my heart, and matching my mind with what's demonstrated to work. Mm-hmm. So I've spent a lot of time focusing on laying out that plan, and there's no doubt it's caused controversy. Some would have advised just to say what's wrong with the other guys and lay low and let them toss the Liberals out. This election is going to be challenging enough. I've got two very strong opponents. We're going to have the Working Families Coalition, special interest spending a lot of money. So I take this election very, very seriously. It's going to be a tough slog. But getting Ontario back is going to be even harder. And I need a mandate to bring in that change. So I looked at what effectively is going to get us moving again. Lower taxes, lower energy, we've talked about. The smaller government. We've gone from being a pro-job creation, pro-entrepreneurship province to one of smaller dreams and bigger government. I want smaller government and a place where you can dream again. Part of that is a great dream new Canadians have when they come to Ontario. It is heartbreaking when you run into people who left the old country to come to a new one, who had full faith in this great Ontario dream that they could put their skills to work, they provide for their family, they could climb the economic ladder, to come here and find out that their credentials aren't recognized, going from a proud professional to getting by in a survivor job. I mean, the proud, they can still put bread on the table, but they say, this is not what I came here for. When I see top university students at the University of Ottawa or Toronto, engineering from China or India, I think our goal should be to offer them an accelerated path to citizenship to put their skills to work here in the province of Ontario, to add to the dynamic nature of our economy. Just think of the values and the character it takes to pack up and leave one country, to come to another where you may not know the language or the culture. That's an incredible talent set that we need to put to work to get Ontario back on top again.
One of the main jobs that Ontarians allot to their provincial government is education. You're calling for better performance on tests, and you say that Ontario can do that with fewer teachers and fewer teachers' assistants. How would you reconcile that?
A lot that we've put on the table come about from the Drummond Commission, including those at school boards in our province. 225,000 fewer students in our schools than 2003. It's almost 250,000 fewer. We've increased expenditures by $8.5 billion. So more money, fewer students, and our test scores have gone down in critical areas like mathematics. So it's not working. So Drummond said, okay, how do we make sure we can protect important services like helping kids with learning disabilities, schools that are failing our students? We have 300 schools whose more than half the students are failing basic tests on literacy and mathematics. How do you make sure we can help those kids? One of the recommendations was to reduce the number of non-teaching personnel in the school board bureaucrats. He said they'd grown by about 15,000. We could check that for Paul. It was in that neighborhood. 225,000 fewer kids, 15,000 more non-teaching personnel in our schools. He said you could reduce that by about 10,000. I know not everybody agrees with that decision, but I believe that Drummond did his homework. We'll incorporate that recommendation in large parts of the Drummond Commission report. We do that to balance our books, to send a signal we're open for job creation, but also to enhance services for kids with special needs. The other area, actually, looks I'm looping into it, is to raise the bar when it comes to mathematics and science.
That's Ontario PC leader Tim Hudak speaking with Maclean's political editor Paul Wells.
This week, the blackout ended on political ads in the Ontario election campaign, and all parties had their spots ready to go.
Tim Hudak wants to make classrooms more crowded, cut teachers and healthcare, and somehow make our economy grow by firing 100,000 people.
Liberal leader Kathleen Wynne chose to start with an attack on Tim Hudak, while the New Democrats had their crosshairs placed on Wynne.
Liberals wasted billions on e-health Orange canceling gas plants. Liberals gave public CEOs huge bonuses, outrageous salaries. This waste happened while Wynne raised the price of hydro rates.
While the two other parties were tossing out attacks, the PCs went with a promotional piece on that million jobs plan we just heard about.
Isn't it time to try a new and different track to put people back to work and Ontario back in business?
A working Ontario is a better Ontario.
To take a deeper look into these ads, we're joined now by Jonathan Rose, an associate professor of political studies at Queen's University. Rose is an expert on political advertising, writing books and papers like Are Negative Ads Positive? Rose speaks with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes.
Let's start with Tim Hudak, who's in some ways has been sort of dominating the debate. One of Hudak's key ads starts with some images of skilled, unemployed individuals, and they turn toward the camera and say, I want to work. And then we hear some sort of David Foster-ish piano playing and Hudak delivering a speech in the legislature. Finally, the words million jobs plan appear in white on a blue background. So what do you think about this? The choice of using Hudak giving a speech in the legislature rather than, you know, something written particularly for the commercial, does that work for you?
Well, I mean, the first thing I want to say is when you're looking at political ads of the three parties, what's interesting to note is what they highlight and what they ignore. And Tim Hudak, so far in the ads I've seen, all portray him either in the legislature making a speech or on a grand stage. And this is really an attempt for him to reframe himself as a premier in waiting, if you will. Contrast that to Kathleen Wynne, who is always outside of the legislature, is either running, talking to people, shaking hands, and is seen as much more active. So I think what Hudak is doing is trying to reframe how voters perceive him and get voters to think of him as a premier in waiting. This ad, I think, works really well because it's stark, the repetition of I want to work, I think, reinforces the message that there are people who want to work. What's interesting about it is, of course, the assumption that's made in the ad is that they can't work because of the government. And the ad really directs people to the website, which is what a lot of ads are doing.
What about the element of his campaign that it does rely on a memorable slogan, perhaps more than the other parties do? This million jobs plan is the refrain, the slogan, the phrase that they want to stick in people's heads. Does that tend to work in political campaigns, having a pithy, you know, summary quote like that that people can fasten on?
Well, I mean, I think any slogan works if it's plausible. And million jobs plan is memorable, but it seems implausible. So there's no real development or idea about how these million jobs will come about. And I think because of that, it reduces the sort of plausibility of the slogan. What it does do is it reminds voters what Hudak is all about. One thing you can say about this election, which I think is great, is that there are really clear distinctions, at least between the Liberals and the Conservatives. So it harkens back to Mike Harris, where voters have a clear, different policy platform than the two leaders. And actually, I think that's good.
Moving on to Kathleen Wynne's ads, you've already touched on the fact that we see her moving around a lot, you know, jogging, walking in what looks like an ordinary suburban neighborhood. But another element of her ads is that there is this attack element to them, at least. She's got one that asks, is Andrea Horvath for real? Another that poses the rhetorical question, can Tim Hudak be trusted? Well, what do you make of that, of her both asking those questions, you know, going on that directly on the attack, and also putting her own voice into those ads? I mean, it's not like she makes those attacks behind an anonymous narrator or some other person in her party.
Well, I think what she's doing is playing on her idea of her as a policy wonk. So she says clearly, I'm not about negative ads, but I do want to make a clear distinction. And the distinction she makes I mean, I think is in some ways justifiable, but in other ways, a bit implausible. So, for example, one ad called Build Ontario Up is a classic feel-good ad, but it makes assumptions that the other guys don't want to build Ontario up.
Mm.
So all ads use what's called associational logic, and that is that they try to get the viewer to make connections where no connections exist. And in all parties' ads so far, they invite the viewer to make inferences which aren't made at all in the ad. I think it's notable that Kathleen Wynne is walking in what appears to be a large suburban neighborhood, and it's a single solitary figure. So that suggests to me that her political capital is still pretty strong, that people put faith in her as opposed to the Liberal brand.
That's interesting.
But what's really interesting about this as well is that there have been lots of studies about the different assumptions viewers make about female leaders versus male leaders. And female leaders have a much more burdensome role. They have to look like leaders. They have to be assertive. They have to be active. But at the same time, they have to maintain so-called traditional female characteristics. It's a bit unfair for female leaders because they're held to different standards. But in this ad, I think she does that.
Hmm.
It's about her. It's about her walking down the street, looking straight in the camera. And that kind of direct connection, I think, reinforces a lot of those positive messages.
I do find it striking that the but we'll move on to Andrea Horvath in a minute, but the Tory and Liberal ads have the conservative leader is speaking to another crowd of people. The Liberal leader is speaking right at you, the viewer, right? And I'm not saying one is better than the other necessarily, but there are two very different approaches to presenting your leader.
Yeah, that's right. And speaking directly to you is much more engaging.
Hmm.
And the fact that there's nothing else distracting in the ad makes it more Spartan, and I think draws your attention to the subject, which is the leader.
Jonathan, moving on to the NDP for a sec, to me the most striking of the Horvath spots I've seen so far is the one where they have white characters on a red background, sort of a speeding odometer tallying up what the NDP says the Liberals have wasted in office. So you're seeing the dollar figure rising, and the narrator isn't Andrew Horvath, but it's a sort of standard voiceover guy. I guess the idea is to declare that the Liberals can't run from their scandals, that there's sort of a clear arithmetic to them. What do you make of those ads? Does that seem effective to you?
Well, I mean, that sort of odometer ad, if you will, I think is a sort of classic trope of political advertising. It's been used to death.
Mm.
It's the idea that, you know, the numbers spin, and that spinning represents something bad, the deficit, taxes, whatever. The fact that that is the main visual for about 28 seconds of the ad, I think means that people's interests are going to be lost. I think it's not a very creative ad. It has very low production values. And interestingly enough, the leader, Andrea Horvath, is mentioned just briefly at the end.
And we don't hear her voice, eh?
That's right. We don't hear her voice.
Yeah.
And it's an attempt to, so what that does is attempt to distance the message from the leader. So they're trying to paint the Kathleen Wynne's Liberals in the same way as Dalton McGuinty. In fact, the last frame, I think, has them literally in a frame, a gold frame.
Mm.
And I think this is, again, a strategy in order to portray Wynne's no different than Dalton McGuinty.
Interesting. Jonathan, thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, thanks.
That's McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Jonathan Rose, an Associate Professor of Political Studies at Queen's University.
Before we head to break, we wanted to update you on another race. This one has candidates trying to become the next Premier of Alberta. Former Federal Cabinet Minister Jim Prentice finally made it official, announcing he will run in the leadership race for the Alberta Progressive Conservative Party.
I believe that this opportunity can only be realized, will only be realized with a clear plan, with strong leadership, and with hard work. And I'm running fundamentally, my friends, because I love this place and I think I have a duty to make it better.
The party and government are looking to rebuild after several scandals involving Alison Redford, who stepped down as premier. While Prentice is heavily favored to win, it will not be a coronation. MLAs Rick McIver and Thomas Lukaszczyk have announced they are also running. Alberta PCs will choose their new leader on September 6th.
Coming up, we speak with one of the leaders of the Election Observer mission to Ukraine. We take a look at the state of the Liberal Party in Quebec, and we discuss the battle between the Catholic Church and Justin Trudeau. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we talk about the Quebec woes facing the Liberal Party, and the McLean's panel weighs in on this battle between the Catholic Church and Liberal leader Justin Trudeau over the issue of abortion.
But first, we're going to take a look at the presidential election in Ukraine. On Sunday, Ukrainians will cast their ballot to choose a new president after Viktor Yanukovych fled the country in February over the ongoing Euromaidan protests. Since then, Russia has invaded and occupied the Crimean region, and there have been deadly clashes between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russia militants in the eastern part of the country.
This vote is seen as a potential turning point in the conflict, but there are fears there could be interference with the democratic process. Canada will play a big role in the election. We've sent 500 observers to Ukraine to make sure the vote is fair and the ballots are counted correctly. But with ongoing conflicts, security is a major concern. The mission is being led by former Ontario Premier Mike Harris and Conservative Senator Raynell Andrewchuk. Senator Andrewchuk joins me now over the phone from Kiev.
Thank you for your interest.
I guess we'll start off by just asking you, what is the main point of this mission? What are you going to be doing there in Ukraine?
Well, we are a mission that will be observing the election, so we will follow the normal observation responsibilities, and that is that we come to observe the election, and we will make a report as to whether they have met the international standards and the Ukrainian laws. And as you know, it is a very difficult time in Ukraine, and I think this is Canada's response to support the people who want to demonstrate their free will to express who they want as their leaders.
And what role do you play as observers? Like, what exactly will you be looking for while people are casting their ballots at these polling stations throughout Ukraine?
Well, normally you start way before the election day, and so you assess whether there has been access to the press for all political parties that throw their hats into the ring. You look at whether the Electoral Commission is ready and capable of overseeing the election, and that means the distribution of the ballot boxes, the registration system. They want to have an international scrutiny so that when they say a particular person wins, they have at least the comments of the international community. So what we do is we look at the Ukraine laws and we look whether what they say they're going to do, how they do it, what they deem to be fair. Then we go out and observe on the day to see, in fact, they've met their own standards. Now, what's different about this particular election is, of course, that Ukraine has recently been invaded, if I may say, or it's certainly interfered with in Crimea and some parts of eastern Ukraine. So the question will be whether in certain parts that they've called hotspots, the Electoral Commission will be able to have an election, because there have been people who've taken over the election stations and have indicated there shall not be an election.
So will Canadian observers be heading to those areas where it's not clear really who's in charge at this point?
No, because we are very concerned about security. And we're in touch with the Ukrainian authorities. We're in touch with other observer missions to determine whether it is safe and secure to go in. The second thing is, some spots, the Electoral Commission has not been able to set up the polling stations, and they have said that they will not be able to deliver the elections in those. But it is a moving target, and we rely on security. Information. We have security people here to assist us to ensure that our observers are safe, and the Ukraine Electoral Commission and the Ukrainian government are determining where they can actually hold an election.
You've been on election observer missions in the past. This is not your first go-round on this. but
right.
Never have we seen such a tense situation as this in more recent history anyway in this region. So I mean, are you nervous at all about what might happen?
Well, I'm not nervous because we have worked on plans. We are coordinated with other international monitors. We are coordinated with security services here, with the government here. We're coordinated with virtually anyone who will be in that area. There has been an appeal for outside countries not to interfere. And we have recently heard comments of some key figures in that area who are indicating they want the election to go forward. So we're taking every precaution. Now, when you say in this area, I have been involved in monitoring in it, other places where they have been very tense. And as you know, we've had recent elections in Afghanistan, et cetera, where the people with difficulty still had the determination to go to the polls. And so I think you have to weigh the security issues and you have to then see whether you can go into those areas. If they are not safe, we will not go in.
Is there a worry that there could be violence on Election Day?
I think the indications are that people are aware that there might be the possibilities. The zones that seem to be critical will not be entered by international observers and perhaps not Ukrainian. And those final decisions have not been made because it is fluid. But you know that sometimes there's what I call ancillary issues. And even those are being discussed because you may think you know where the action may be that is of a negative nature, but you have to have a plan and you have to survey the entire scene.
So when it comes to security for hundreds of Canadians there, what's it going to be like? Are they setting up security in each polling station so the observers will be protected at those polling stations? Do you have one security member for every Canadian observer? How does that exactly work out?
We have a security personnel, both from the Canadian embassy here and coming in from Ottawa, who made a security assessment. And it would appear to be that the elections will be safe and secure in most parts of Ukraine, except in the far two zones in eastern Ukraine. And that's where we will not go in if it's not safe. So we have backup, we have plans, we have exit plans, we have strategies coordinated with all of the other international observers. So it will not be just Canada's decision, it will be a coordinated decision, and we will all work in concert. So we've had the security briefings. The feedback from the observers are that they are comfortable with the concern for their safety. They understand the risk. They have a responsibility to protect themselves. If at any time they even feel somewhat uncomfortable, they will be immediately dispatched out. But where we're deploying at this time, we feel that they're not in the insecure areas, they will be in the secure areas, and that would mean that those two oblasts will probably not be covered by us unless the security situation improves. And that's true for other observers.
Senator, one last question for you. I'm just wondering, is there a feeling amongst not just the Canadian delegation but other international delegations that maybe this vote could help bring some calm to the crisis that's happening in eastern Ukraine right now?
There is a feeling that we're in the transition here. The Maidan uprising really was a collective, a strong signal from Ukrainian people that they'd had enough of the kind of leadership they had, the siphoning off of resources, not into their welfare. And so I think there's a collective, and it's shown itself in different ways. So if there is a good election in most of this country, I think the incoming president will have a huge responsibility to deal with the pressing issues of the varying regions and to deal with a foreign policy that will look west, but will understand its border with Russia and its relationship there. I think there are people who are going to the polls searching for a new era. They're in transition because the present regime has made some very good moves, but they are transition teams, and they will not be there after the election in these same capacities. So I think the next president is where the changes that are necessary will come in Ukraine, and hopefully there will be a response from the country. That's why this election is so important. If the people express their will and they do it freely, I think that the leadership will have to respond. If they can overcome and settle the violence, if they can have a peaceful election, I trust there will be a better future for Ukraine.
That's Senator Raynell Andruchuk, one of the leaders of the Election Observer Mission to Ukraine. There are 20 candidates running to be the next Ukrainian president. One of them needs 50% of the vote to become the new leader. If they can't get that support in the first vote, the list will be whittled down and a second vote will be held in June.
Coming up, we discuss the organizational problems in Quebec facing the Federal Liberal Party, the Catholic Church versus Justin Trudeau, and why the Conservative Party has put a hotly contested nomination race on hold.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Coming up, the Maclean's panel takes a look at the vicious nomination battle in the Conservative Party and Liberal leader Justin Trudeau's battle with the Catholic Church over abortion.
But first, we're going to look at the state of the federal Liberals in Quebec and whether the party has the proper organization in place to run a solid campaign in 2015. It's the topic of an article in this week's issue of Maclean's by our Quebec Bureau Chief, Martin Patrickin, and he joins me now by phone.
I guess just in short, what do you make of how the Liberal Party is doing and what maybe the future holds for them in that province?
This week I wrote a piece about sort of the de-Quebecanization of the Liberal Party of Canada, if I can make up a word. There are grumblings amongst certain liberals in the province that the party is being governed more and more in Toronto and Ottawa at the expense of Quebec, and that doesn't make people very happy. Quebec, as you know, is fairly nationalist. Even Federalists are fairly nationalist, and they like to have their own thing. And one of the complaints that I'm hearing a lot is that the machinations of the party, and as well as the people that are surrounding Justin Trudeau, tend to be non-francophones, not to put too fine a point on it.
In what way does this matter? Does this just sort of upset people, or is this an actual organizational issue that affects the party or could affect the party in an election?
The Liberals I spoke to, and among them was Yvon Lemire, who is a former higher up with the party. Sort of says that treating Quebec like any other province is a mistake. Isn't something that the Liberal Party should do, because, as we all know, Quebecers politics are done differently in Quebec. And to sort of have a one size fits all for everyone across the country isn't necessarily the best of ideas. That's the complaint. Now, the party itself is quick to point out that, you know, there are a number of francophones. While a number of francophones have left Justin's office since he became leader, there are a number of francophones around him still, like people like Dan Gagne, Jean Charest, former right-hand man. But the criticism still sticks at an organizational level, is that the Liberals are going to have a difficult time becoming motivated to go into an election if they feel their party is ignoring them in the province of Quebec.
The 2011 election, it's a bit tough, I guess, to make it a precedent for many things in Quebec. But, you know, just a devil's advocate of this, you look at the NDP, they didn't exactly have a lot of organization in Quebec. They did tailor their message for the province, and they did maybe catch lightning in a bottle. But does that show that maybe there's an opening there that maybe you don't need necessarily to have a big Quebec operation?
You know what? To be perfect, I think that's a very fair assessment, and I think that's what a lot of people around Justin Trudeau are expecting. They think that look, the guy's popular here, and there's a thinking that, you know, that popularity of the leader, you know, young, telegenic, able to get on TV very, very easily, you know, good with a sound clip, that whole thing, is gonna gloss over a lot of the structural problems that the party has had, and through no fault of Justin Trudeau, through the fault of the fact that they don't have very many people elected here. In other words, they're sort of expecting that there's going to be sort of a Jack Layton-style wave, as there was with the NDP, as will be for the Liberal Party of Canada in 2015.
Is there any sense, I mean, I guess the thinking is that the main threat in Quebec for the Liberals is still the NDP, and that's who you have to get past. Is there any sense, or do you get any sense of where the NDP stands and how that battle is shaping up?
The NDP is surprisingly resilient. You know, fearmongers across the country, pundits, people, you know, even I said, you know, can the NDP survive the death of Jack Layton and the appointment of Thomas Mulcair? I think Mr. Mulcair has proven people right, that while he doesn't necessarily have the, you know, the happy warrior image of Jack Layton, he's an incredibly agile politician, and the NDP's numbers have remained quite high in Quebec, creeping up even on Justin Trudeau's.
And where does this, you know, if the Liberal Party can manage to maybe get its organization in line in Quebec, or, you know, maybe soothe some concerns there, what even then ends up being the message, do you think, for the Liberals in Quebec? Because as you point out in your story, they don't really have, with the Quebec election going the way it did, they don't really have to worry about a sovereignty crisis. So what, which is used to be the kind of that Liberal appeal.
And that's one of the aspects that, you know, Trudeau, to a certain extent, like his father, is when it comes to the separatist issue, is a hammer, and all he sees is nails, you know. Mm-hmm. And that works. That would have worked very well if the PQ had gotten elected. It takes away one of the biggest nails in his view, because there is no PQ. There's no PQ threat. There's no separatist threat to sort of campaign on in the province.
And so, what do you imagine they end up selling themselves as a you know, do they have to argue that maybe they can govern, or that they can, you know,
I think that this is probably a smart strategy on their part, is the same as for Quebec as the rest of the country, the open government, do politics differently, you know, go big on big issues like abortion and marijuana, try to get the youth vote out, and, you know, capture some of that, like you said, lightning the bottle. Instead, get Justin Trudeau there to do that instead of someone like Jack Layton. And look, they have a hell of a candidate to do it. Whatever organizational woes they have in Quebec, Justin Trudeau still pulls a lot of press here.
That was McLean's Quebec Bureau Chief Martin Patrickin discussing how Quebec's role is diminishing in the federal Liberal Party.
It's time now for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, joined, as always, by my co-host, Aaron Wherry, the Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine, and John Geddes, the Ottawa Bureau Chief for McLean's. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
All right, we're going to keep with the Liberal theme here and focus now on Liberal leader Justin Trudeau and his, I guess, little battle with the Catholic Church over the issue of abortion. And just to recap the issue, Justin Trudeau said all of his future candidates have to vote pro-choice. They can have anti-abortion views if they want, but when it comes down to it, if it ever gets to the House of Commons, they have to vote pro-choice. Catholic Church doesn't really like that. So cardinals and archbishops are now calling for a meeting with Trudeau, and he is not granting it. He's not denying them, but he's not granting a meeting either. So I guess the first question, Aaron, has the Liberal Party lost control of this issue now?
I think maybe to a certain degree this wasn't quite. I suspect there wasn't a grand plan that this is what they would spend the last week and a half doing. Uh, I I think this did just sort of come out of the blue during during his scrum after caucus last week, and it has just sort of snowballed from there. The longer-term ramifications of it are a bit harder to gauge. The Catholic vote didn't seem to be going the Liberals' way in previous years to begin with. So maybe that hurts them, that continues to hurt them here again. On the other hand, maybe this shores up their vote on sort of the left side of the ledger and protects them against attacks from, for instance, the NDP, who would say they weren't, you know, sufficiently pro-choice. If the Liberal caucus had, you know, numerous sort of pro-life candidates or MPs, they might have had to answer for that too. So, you know, it's a bit of, you know, what do you want to sort of have to explain? Either your strident pro-choice position or position of being pro-choice but also having pro-life MPs.
John, was this a strategy or is this a strategy from the Liberals to try and encroach on a new Democrat territory? I mean, we saw it with marijuana and now we're seeing it with abortion.
There's no question that the Liberals have to push the NDP down to pre-Jack Layton orange wave kind of levels. The arithmetic of Canadian politics doesn't allow the two parties on the left and center left to split things the way they did last time and beat the Tories. So that's a fact. I doubt they, as going back to what Aaron says, I can't see this as having been a very planned strategy. I am a little bit surprised in a way that Trudeau has seemed to be improvising his way as much as he has on this, though. I mean, I think he coming back to clarify that he wasn't going to require prospective Liberal MPs to declare that they were pro-choice, that he merely needed them to declare that they would vote pro-choice. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I don't think he's been clear yet whether abstaining on a vote is acceptable. I think that
He hasn't touched on that yet.
That will have to be acceptable, I think. One of the reasons that I wonder why this wasn't clear in his mind, the minds of his strategists, this really goes back a long way. Many people would say the watershed in North American politics on this was when then New York Governor Mario Cuomo gave an important speech at Notre Dame University in 1984, back in the days just after Pierre Trudeau was out of office, clarifying the claim that a Catholic politician or a politician who had Catholic roots could be pro-choice in public policy terms, and that wouldn't affect his beliefs in terms of personal morality or his openness to other people having a personal morality that leaned in some different direction. So this is a very old and complex file. And, you know, a lot of sophisticated political operators have long since figured out how to talk about abortion. I would argue that Stephen Harper is pretty good at talking about it. He basically accepts the complexity of it and dismisses the notion of ever reopening the debate. That's not a satisfying position for a lot of people, but it's a pretty clear one. Trudeau's position seems to me he's been kind of adjusting it as he goes along here, and I would have thought they'd sort of have that one straightened away before they start talking about it.
And I guess the old line is, if you're explaining, you're losing. So quickly before we go, we want to touch on the Eve Adams nomination battle. The Conservative Party has put that nomination race for Oakville, North Burlington on hold. You have both sides making accusations, one side saying that Eve Adams' camp has signed people up and paid for their memberships, which is against the rule, and Eve Adams' side is saying now that there were illegal robocalls or survey calls being made from the other side. Is this timeout, if you will, is this needed in this nomination race, or should they have actually just let the nomination race go ahead and get it over and done with, deal with it internally, and not have what could end up being weeks and weeks of this troubled-looking nomination battle dogging the Conservative Party?
Cormac, I've spoken in the past with some of Eve Adams' opponents and rivals in that, not quite on yet race for the new riding, and I doubt that they're going to at any point come to terms to have some kind of a polite contest here. So I tend to go with door one, which would be get this over with, rip that bandage off, let there be a messy fight and see who wins and get past it, because I think this just prolongs it. If the thought inside the Conservative Party as well, we'll take some time here, let temperatures cool down, put this on a more normal footing, I'm not sure I see how that happens.
But Aaron, do they risk upsetting normal, like average members when things like membership dues and fees and rules around that are not respected in a nomination battle?
Yeah, I suspect that if just looking at this from the outside and what's being alleged, I suspect the allegations were just serious enough that if they'd let this vote go ahead on Saturday, there would have been people saying the vote wasn't legitimate. And that would have just prolonged this problem. They may never get, as John says, to a point where everybody's agreed that it's been a fair fight. But they can hopefully, I would suspect, get to a place where everybody agrees that voter fraud has or has not taken place. You know, I think the interesting thing to take away from this, if you're not a Conservative Party member, is that nomination races, as we're seeing across the Liberals and the Conservatives now, are messy affairs.
All right. Thank you very much, Aaron Wary, the associate editor of Maclean's, also the co-host here, and John Geddes, the Ottawa bureau chief for Maclean's. Thanks very much for joining us.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.